I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Dr. Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
On this episode of the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, we're going to be talking with Dr. Carlo DiClemente. Dr. DiClemente is an emeritus professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and he's a former president of the Society of Addiction Psychology. We're going to be talking with him about the trans-theoretical model of behavior change.
Carlo, welcome to the show. We're really excited to have you. Such an honor to have you on with us, and I know our listeners will be really happy to hear what you have to talk about today.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be here and to support the Division 50 kind of initiative. It's great.
Huge fan of your work. A bunch of your work has really been inspirational, both to my clinical work and my research. And so just really honored to have you on the show. Each episode we begin talking a little bit about about our guest's background. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your training history and your background.
Sure. So psychology wasn't my first career. So I did, I went into seminary relatively early in my life and kind of went through, studied theology in Rome, and have a licentiate in theology from the Gregorian University in Rome. And then came back and worked in parishes for about 4 years before deciding that this isn't really what I wanted to do or needed to do, and moved on to psychology. I did my master's degree at the New School for Social Research in New York, and then got into Rhode Island, University of Rhode Island, and was there for my graduate work and the PhD work. And that's where Jim and I got together. Jim was not my first advisor, Jim Prochaska, but he I moved to him at the end of my graduate career to kind of have him be my mentor for my research. So that's kind of the story of that. And then I went down to Texas. So I was in Texas to do internship and a postdoctoral fellowship, and then kind of stayed there for a number of years before coming back up to Maryland.
We found that a lot of people have a way less linear path than one might expect to the destinations. And I think all of that variety really adds to people's work and adds to our, you know, understanding of the field. And so, you know, thanks for sharing that. And training in Rome is very serious work. It's really interesting.
Did you learn any Italian?
Yes, I did, actually. And I'm actually doing some consulting in Italy these days, because I actually can speak Italian.
Wow.
Broken Italian, I will say. But yes, I can do that. And so do some consulting over there, go over once a year at least to do some work in Reggio Emilia. And I'm going in June to Pisa to do some work with workplace health group. So yeah, it's been fun.
It's really interesting how, I guess, like, you probably didn't expect to be going back to Italy to be doing this when you were there learning,
right.
You know, but it's a crazy journey life takes us on. And something I think our country, it gives us, it's a disservice, right? We never learn other languages. So
yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, very cool. Well, speaking of nonlinear pathways and change, I guess, over time, that's what, you know, your work definitely spans like a lot of different areas, and your impact can be felt sort of all over the field of clinical psychology and of addiction. But we wanted to have you on to talk about your work developing the trans-theoretical model of behavior change. So we're just absolutely thrilled to have you to hear your thoughts about this. And we were just wondering if we could sort of start with the beginning, what was the inspiration behind the model?
Want to kind of acknowledge the tremendous work that Jim Prochaska did. He died this past year and contributed a lot to the field, along with myself, in terms of our working together and also working independently. So I just want to dedicate some of this, the kudos and all the other kind of stuff, to Jim as well. Why I moved over to Jim was because I was in a class that was systems of psychotherapy. And Jim Prochaska was working on trying to find kind of, like Marv Goldfield says, kind of principles of change. Because the problem was that as you review the literature across a variety of interventions, the interventions always do better than weightless controls, but not better than each other. And you can think, well, that was back in the 70s and the 80s, but that's not true. We just finished the Project Match a number of years ago, and we had three different treatments for alcohol problems. And basically all three treatments that were different in philosophy and in size. Two were 12-week and one was 4-week, the motivational enhancement therapy. They all had equal outcomes. And so the whole idea about are there really, 250 therapies? Aren't there some way to kind of bring this back together? So Jim was looking for those principles of change. And I ambitiously kind of decided for my dissertation that I would try and test his idea. And basically he wanted me to do this in smoking, because Jim was trained as more in behavioral, and goes, smoking is good. The outcomes, you can count the outcomes. It's really good. And I was smoking, so I said, no, I don't want to do smoking. I'm smoking. I don't want to do smoking cessation. So basically, then we kind of, after negotiating, he was very convincing, and I was doing smoking, and so I decided to kind of create something to look at the processes and see how important were some of these processes that Jim had outlined in his book on systems of psychotherapy to quitting. And if people used more processes, did that mean that they, and did they use it from different groups? So I had a group of people who quit through Schick, which was a deconditioning kind of program, some people who quit through using cognitive behavioral, and some people who quit on their own. Because my sense was, if this is really a common process, it's not just common to therapy or to quitting something, it's common to if you do it on your own, not just in treatment. So that's where we kind of got started. I kind of created some measures of the processes and did that kind of stuff and interviewed a bunch of people and followed them and looked at that. And the interesting thing was, when you asked people, what was this important to you? So the different processes were things like making a decision and changing the way I saw myself as a smoker and doing those kind of things, which are the processes that we have in the model now. That they would ask me, well, when do you mean? Do you mean before I quit? Do you mean when I kind of joined this quote program? Do you mean now that I've actually quit? And so you realize that there had to be some kind of a dimension of time and tasks that really kind of was there. So from that, Jim and I kind of start talking, and people had been writing a little bit about contemplation. So they were, because there was a lot of work in the early 70s in terms of decision making and how to think about things and subjective expected utility and all of those kind of things. So basically we kind of looked at that, and then Marlatt was doing his work on maintenance. He was really doing relapse prevention, but it was really a maintenance model. And so we kind of said, well, maybe there's a dimension of time and tasks that really are there. So that's how we came up with the different stages. We also found that basically what was happening is most of our treatments were action oriented, and many of our patients weren't. And so instead of calling people, and this was also an addiction time where people were being called in denial and the diseases of denial and all those kind of things and resistance. And so we decided not to kind of label, but to put somebody just in pre-contemplation. So you're not quite thinking about changing yet. And then kind of built the model, the contemplation, because we knew decision making was important. And then we kind of went into the first versions of the model, we couldn't get preparation when we actually were doing some research. So we kind of just went pre-contemplation, contemplation, action, maintenance. And then later, as we did more research and designed it, we thought about it as a decision-making stage, but we ended up calling it a preparation stage. And so those were the stages of change, and then that informed all of our research. Luckily, NCI was looking at how people quit smoking because 95% of the people quit on their own. And so they said, we really want to kind of find out how people quit. And we now had some data in from my dissertation. So we created a grant application and we're funded with a group of people, a group of other investigators looking at how people quit on their own. And that really was the beginning of the model. We, Jim and I had a site in Texas. He had a site in Rhode Island, and we did research for 9 years together on the model and kind of creating the model and building the model. The model also had, you know, for my dissertation, one of the things I didn't tell my committee, but I put into the study was a self-efficacy measure. Because Bandura had just been writing about self-efficacy, so I thought, that sounds really interesting. So I put a measure of self-efficacy for quitting smoking in my dissertation. And so we start thinking about that in terms of the model, and then we start thinking about decision making and how so decisional balance and self-efficacy got included as concepts from elsewhere that we kind of fit in as markers of the change process. And then the other trans-theoretical part of that is that when we first came out with the model, people goes, oh, well, that's good for smoking, but it doesn't really have anything to do with anybody else or anything else and changing any other behaviors. And the two things we thought, well, it does really, because when you're changing anything, you would have this same process. So it's a process of change, not a process of quitting smoking. And that led us to kind of thinking also, though, however, every change happens in the context of that person's life. And that's where we came in with the levels of change, or as we now, as I now call them, the context of change. And there's different areas in the context of change that you need to kind of pay attention to. So even if you're just changing smoking, if you've got mental health issues going on, that's going to impact that change process. So that ended up becoming the background or the larger, more ecologically larger framework for any particular change being set into.
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning here at this point that like it's so ingrained in the consciousness of our field, this process where, and this has happened a few times when we talked to people recently where we're like, people are going to be listening to this and think like, well, yeah, of course, stages, you know, like this is how this is. But it's important to note that like at the time, this isn't how
Radical.
people were thinking. So like, I guess what were, I mean, you kind of touched on this a little bit that it was just denial and stuff like that, but what was that paradigm shift like? How did the field experience it, kind of, I guess?
Well, I think originally, I mean, what was really interesting is that as we start publishing it first on the model, Bill Miller was doing some stuff with his program for drinkers. So where he would do his program where he kind of recruit them and kind of do a brief intervention and then figure out what's happening afterwards. And so we ran into each other in a conference, and I, because he mentioned that, oh, he said, how do these people do this? How do people kind of just with feedback change? And he said, well, there's a new article out that these guys had talked about that might be might help us understand how this happens. And so he re referenced that. So I went up to him afterwards. We talked to him a little bit, and he was planning the International Conference on the Treatment of Addictive Behaviors in Scotland at the time. And we talked a bit, and he used the model as the framework for that particular conference. So we had presentations on pre-contemplation and contemplation, and we had presentations. Marlatt was there and talked about maintenance. We had people talking about action and self-regulation. They talked about that. So the international community really kind of, it got spread to the international community much quicker than it did actually the States community. But we had, you know, I think people had different reactions to the model. I mean, some people thought it was very simplistic, which it is, in terms of, you know, I think science sometimes, you know, Occam's razor, you think about the solutions that are the easiest and the clearest maybe are some of the best. But I think, you know, and then there were people who were critics and said, no, that's not really true. I mean, even Bandura had a criticism that said, you know, no, these guys are talking about these, how you go, but you can't move from stage to stage. It's like a butterfly. I mean, you know, the moth becomes the butterfly. It never goes back to the moth. And they're going, yeah, but that's not the point. These are not stages in the sense of, you know, the developmental stages. Once you move out of one, you can't go back to one.
It's not a moth and a butterfly, right?
Exactly. So these are stages that actually kind of mean that they're not boxes. They're not things that you put people into. They're really states where people are, depending on where they have feelings and decisions and thoughts about quitting, and then take action about quitting. And so I think there was some misunderstanding in the beginning of kind of how this worked. And it's been a while. We've had some criticism that some of our colleagues in Great Britain were not always pleased with the model, and they didn't like that it was taking over some of the ideas in the clinical psychology realm. But so we had mixed feelings at the beginning. And then as the research kind of rolled out and more people start doing research in different areas, so, you know, psychotherapy and mammography and looking at diet and looking at exercise and looking at other kind of things, it became clear that this process was useful underlying a lot of the whole change process. So understand that.
That's really interesting. I can't even imagine what it would be like to get criticism from a person like Bandura, right? Like, just like hard to wrap my brain around, right? But like as Sam mentioned here, right? Like, now it's kind of really been embedded in a lot of ways, and perhaps even more implicit than explicit in some training programs. Mm-hmm. But you know, the stages of change or the model broadly, I think, is just so useful. And so perhaps maybe we could just spend a little bit of time helping our listeners understand what are the kind of parts of it. I know you've mentioned a bunch of them already, but just kind of maybe we could just lay it out for the audience here. Like, what are the stages and its kind of constituent parts and such.
So yeah, let me, and I will talk about that first, because I want to tell you about so originally when we talked about quitting smoking, that was stopping a behavior. But we soon began to understand that, well, it could also be used for starting a behavior or for modifying a behavior.
Great point.
And so basically you have different patterns of change, but the same change process seems to be underlying it because it's been used across all of these different areas. And so the first part of that is really, I mean, whenever you think about change, we're all in some stage of change with regard to something in our lives. Whether we're not thinking about changing it, that's usually your spouse is saying, you need to change this. And you go, no, I don't really think I need to do that. Or you're kind of thinking about something, or you're actually in the process of doing it. You joined a gym and now you're starting to go to the gym and doing those kind of things. So the stages really represent tasks that are important if you're going to think about change. So the task of someone in pre-contemplation, if they're going to move forward, is to get some concern or interest in changing. The task in contemplation is really creating a cost-benefits analysis that works for you And that enables you to kind of say, yes, I want to do this and make a decision. The tasks in the preparation stage are really building the commitment to follow through and also building a plan. How am I going to make this change? What's it going to be like? And it can be an extensive plan, but it also can be a very short plan. It doesn't have to be extensive. And then ultimately, you've got to put that plan into action, which is the action phase. And one of the things that tasks that I emphasize in action that I think people don't realize is no plan is perfect. So one of the key elements and one of the key tasks of action is revising the plan if it's not working. Otherwise, people go back and don't and give up on the change. And so the revision is important. And then in maintenance, it's really sustaining and integrating that change into your lifestyle. And so again, it becomes more habitual. And that's what we want with most of the changes that are health behavior changes and anything about chronic illness and those kind of things. We really want the changes to be sustained over time. And so that was the ideas behind the stages and how we kind of kept looking at different parts of that. So we use decisional balance to kind of say, well, if people have a good decisional balance, do they tend to make a change? We use things, efficacy to kind of think about how efficacious do people have to be in order to be successful and doing those kind of things. So that's how those other things fit in. The other element of this, though, is really the processes. So you got to think about the processes as the engines. If you're doing psychotherapy, your job is to activate the processes. So the processes are really important, and we in several number of research projects, we've actually quantified those processes in terms of measures, and also looked at them and kind of saw, well, did factor analysis and all kinds of stuff. And there set, tends to be two sets of processes that come out, a set that is more cognitive experiential and a set that's more behavioral. And that again kind of looks at there's pre-action kinds of tasks that need to be done that require some processes to kind of be activated. And there is action-oriented tasks that need to be done that require more behavioral kinds of processes. And so we then began to think about, well, you need to activate the processes. So self-reevaluation, environmental reevaluation, helping people to change the way they see this change in regard to themselves and their environment, and emotional arousal. We found a number of smokers, for example, would had an emotional experience that actually helped them move forward to make a decision to actually do this. So emotional arousal and so consciousness raising. I mean, all therapies do consciousness raising, trying to give you some framework or understanding of how do you make that. So people have to get an understanding of the change and do that, and then they need to move on to the next process. So that's why the tasks are important, but the processes are the engines or the drivers that help people to move through this process. So those are the two key things, and it's really what the interaction of the stages and the processes that are really at the heart of the transtheoretical model.
Moving people from earlier in those stages through the processes towards the end. I'm curious, do you feel like there any of these processes are more or less important at different stages? Do you find that a lot of the cognitive stuff is happening more often, maybe earlier in the model? That would be like my intuition, but
Yes.
I also imagine that there are elements of, cognitive processes and behavioral processes that sort of play a role throughout. So I was just wondering.
Yeah, and I think some of that depends on which pattern of change you're looking at. So if I'm thinking about initiating, yes, the cognitive processes and the experiential processes are important in the early stages, but they may also stay important in the later stages because I've got to keep doing it. It's different if you're stopping a behavior. because sometimes when you stop a behavior, you let it go. So I quit smoking. That was one person actually benefited from my research. I quit smoking, and so went on and did you know, and after that, you don't want to think about smoking. So what we found even in one study that if you were doing more thinking about the cigarettes and other kind of stuff, it was a predictor of relapse. So you really want to kind of move out of that in maintenance and make this, I just don't smoke. But that's different than diet, and it's different than exercise. So on exercise, I've got to start a behavior and continue that behavior. Diet, I've got to modify that behavior and continue that. So sometimes I think some of the cognitive processes are still important in the later stages. Sometimes they may not be as important, depending on the pattern.
When I hear you talking a lot about identity, it's sort of like dropping an identity when you're changing a behavior, like trying to get rid of a behavior, and almost part of the cognitive process is sort of like becoming someone who thinks about, exercise a lot. And there's a really interesting, because it sounds like, a lot of the Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, there is sort of a culture of identity around sort of letting go of r remaining attached to the identity of being an addict. And so I don't know, this is just, I'm not even sure I have a solid question here, but I guess how have you noticed those types of sort of differences between something like smoking and something like alcohol?
Well, again, I think it depends. I think Alcoholics Anonymous has done a great job in terms of supporting and helping people move through the change process. And actually, early on, I did a chapter in a book on Alcoholics Anonymous, looking at the 12 steps and the traditions and how those can fit into kind of the process of change that we had talked about. So I do think that that's very important. Where I think that we kind of diverge a little bit is are two things. One, where I think you by keeping by you're one drink away from becoming an alcoholic again or something. I think that taking on of the identity is helpful for some people, but may not be as helpful for other people. Because I think that for some folks, they need to just leave it behind. Now, as I say that, I say, I'm a smoker, so I have been a smoker, so I'm not like any of you people who have never smoked. So I could go back to smoking more quickly than you guys could probably start. Okay. But that's because my brain has probably some residue of nicotine receptors in there that I kind of did at a earlier age. And I know how to smoke, and I know how to do it, and I know what I did it for 10 years, so I know that. So, but for me now, if I wanted to go back to smoking, it would not be what we call a relapse. It would be called a reinitiation. And so I'd have to start again. And a lot of times when you see folks who have been, sober for 6 years or 8 years and then go back, people say, oh, well, they relapsed after 6 or 8 years. I go, I don't know that. I mean, if you've created something and lived something for 6 or 8 years, is it really, I think you went through the process of change again. And you made a change. It wasn't just a slip that you kind of did. So I think that the identity issue is an important one. I mean, we do think of ourselves as our habits. And so that's really what habits are, is habits are part of who we are. But we also shed our habits and change and make new habits. And then that becomes who we are. So identity isn't a set thing that we have here. We keep creating our identity as we go along by making the changes that we make, or not making the changes that we make, that we should make.
I like that. It sounds like this is sort of where the context, you know, talking about for some people, it actually might be helpful to hold on to that identity in some way or another. And for others, it might not. It sounds like that's kind of where that context of change sort of comes in and is a part of this and determining, well, we have these general processes, but then the way that they're applied might look different depending on the person.
On the person, right. And
yeah,
I think again, you know, we are talking about the processes are the province of the person. They're not the therapy processes. The therapy processes are to help engage the processes of the person.
Right.
So that's how I kind of see it. And so again, it's not most of the research that we do is focused on us. We like to focus on us as either the therapist or the therapy procedures or the things that we're doing or the therapeutic
right.
relationship. We have lots and lots of research on that. But the real mover of change is the client.
Yeah.
And we need to focus more on the client.
That's a great point. I train therapists and teach empirically supported treatments and stuff here in our training program. And I haven't used that language, but I like it better than perhaps the one I'm using. But I always talk about it like that we don't do anything really. We're educators at best, right? Or motivators at best, right? That like we're helping bring attention and awareness and skill to a person's change process, and the change lives within the client.
Right.
All the change happens, most of it happens outside of the room when we're ever together, right? The therapy room is where the least amount of change happens.
Right.
All that happens out there in the world. And our role is to create the circumstances to support that change, right? And that's one of the, I think, a really elegant things about the model here is that it captures a bunch of processes that predate even engaging in treatment or engaging in treatment at all, right? The idea that a person, you know, many people in states of, you know, of various behaviors and things in their lives are, you know, kind of existing in a state of perpetual pre-contemplation. There's nothing to see here, right? And then, but eventually something happens and it's like, wait a second, maybe I should engage with at least thinking about a change, which is where that contemplation phase comes in. And in addiction, it's slightly different because a lot of people, there tend to be a lot of outside voices about your behavior that perhaps alert you that maybe we need to take a peek at this compared to something else. Right. And then they have to kind of make a decision to do some of these things. And that's usually when a person engages with psychotherapy, right? It's like they're like, I should probably do something about this. I'm gonna have to call a person and do an intake and do all this stuff. Then they show up to us and it's, you know, mostly, you know, preparation and action and maintenance that tends to happen here. And depending on what kind of treatment you're talking about, I remember a supervisor I had long ago talked about like residential treatment, for instance, for substance use disorders as a mechanism by which to help a person move a single stage of change. Right. Which is a lot of them are in we're doing preparation here, right? Like we're not going to go back to your life and engage with all the stimulus out there and your family and all that stuff. Right. And that we're really thinking about the changes and some of them are happening here, but the action is really going to take a lot of out there.
Right.
But the thing that you mentioned here that I think I haven't really conceptualized as much, you know, I think people kind of talk about it as like a ring, right? Where like, you know, people move backwards and forwards through these various stages where you can move all the way to maintenance, right? And then move backwards. But the idea to move from maintenance back to pre-contemplation and the same behavior here as a reinitiation, I think is a really interesting concept that I hadn't really thought about much, but makes total sense in people's lives, right? Like if you've been, you know, not smoking for 20 years and then you pick it back up, there's all of this, you know, these grooves that are easy to fall back into, but, you know, cause you have that learning, that lived experience, but it still would take some effort to make happen.
To make a new decision.
Yeah. You have to make a whole new decision, right? It wouldn't just be reflexive, right? Like it was.
Right. It's just not early on when I would pick up a cigarette, you know, in the first 6 months that I quit, that would be something different. So you're right. Yeah. And a thought about that is, you know, I often have thought and been asked about, you know, well, what about people in residential?
Yeah.
And I go, well, I don't think people in residential can move beyond preparation.
Yeah. That's how we talked about it where I worked.
Yeah, so
Same.
basically, action is when you leave,
Yeah.
and start doing the work of that. I do think that the therapies also are really important, not only just for motivation and education, but also for skill development. And
Yeah,
there are
how to
some
maintain
things,
it.
once you get into that, like in the planning and the action phases of this, the do they have the skills to actually enforce the plan? To
Yeah.
engage the plan and do that. So I do think that's really interesting. And the other thing is, just because people are in therapy doesn't mean they're ready to change.
Oh, yeah.
So we have people who come in who think about it and decide not to. We
Yeah.
call them dropouts sometimes, but that they are people who
Yeah.
decided not to do anything about this process of change right now, and they go back out. And so I do think, and the other thing we had. I've discovered as we go along is stopping is not quitting. So you can stop a behavior without quitting a behavior. And that's really important because we understood that mostly in terms of pregnant women. I did a number of projects in Houston on with pregnant women. And many of them will stop smoking for the pregnancy. Okay. And people, we used to call it pregnancy smoking cessation. But and I
Yeah.
wrote a we wrote an article, pregnancy book, a case of mistaken identity, because basically most of those women who quit during pregnancy by 3 months out, even though they've been off for like 6 months, which we think is a marker of kind of moving into maintenance, they were all back to smoking at six. I mean, 60, 70% of them were back to smoking 6 months later after postpartum. And when you asked them, it was always for the baby. The decisional considerations were to protect the baby, not for them. And often, as soon as they would give birth or could safely kind of not were not nursing or whatever, they would go back to cigarettes as their, because they hadn't really decided to quit those for themselves.
So,
And go
there are
ahead.
these sort of circumstances where people kind of can take action, which I think is actually really interesting in terms of just like the like theory, like you know, addiction theory, like that there are times when people can, you know, withhold from action.
Sure.
And yet it seems like a critical part of this and change is, I don't know, intrinsic motivation.
Yes.
Is that
That's a good way to talk about it. Yeah, I
Yeah.
think intrinsic motivation is really key if you're thinking about maintenance. So again,
Right.
you can stop a behavior for a period of time. I mean, people go, they get a DUI and they go, okay, I'm not drinking and driving for 6 months because basically that's my parole. I have this thing and I've got to do this for 6 months, so I'm not going to do this. So you can stop a behavior for a period of time. And even in the pattern of behavior, you can actually build in periods when you don't do this. We had a rabbi in one of our smoking studies who smoked like 2 to 3 packs a day. Okay. So was definitely dependent on nicotine, except on the Sabbath.
Wow,
He didn't
yeah.
smoke anything on the Sabbath. Then he went back to 3 packs a day. So you can stop a behavior or put a pause on a behavior without quitting a behavior or
Yeah.
even doing a behavior.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think that brings it back to the point where you're talking about these processes that are happening, right? The cognitive and behavioral processes that are surrounding that decision,
Right.
right? Because, you know, you think about, there's a bunch of different, you know, factors like people will stop for probation or things like this, or because they're in, you know, residential treatment or whatever. And but it's
Right.
what's supporting the infrastructure around that decision that really kind of characterizes a person's movement through maybe these stages or engagement with these processes that are the engine of driving change, which is how they're thinking about the relationship they have with the choice, right?
Right.
Not just that, like, I'm not going to use anymore, but I'm going to build a life around not doing the thing,
Exactly.
right? Or reducing the thing or increasing a
Right.
thing, right? Whereas maybe I just need to, you know, wake up early for a brief period of time and then I'm going to go back to sleeping in, right? And then and that has a totally different kind of set of processes that surround it and support it and help a person, you know, maintain that long term.
Yeah, no, I think that's really right. Two things. One is that we did a, we actually compared women who had quit during pregnancy with women who are quitting smoking, and found that they were not using the processes. So
There it is.
it's you can
So they were
stop
just
it.
kind of trying to stop.
Willpower. They were just kind of doing it. I'm convinced for this reason, this is so important to me that I'm not going to do this for the 9 or 10 months of pregnancy. Period.
They're
And
not
I'm
engaging
not
with any of
using
those
all the
change
other,
processes.
yeah, they're not using some of the other change processes. So it's
That
really
really makes
interesting.
sense, actually. I mean, that really, really makes sense in a lot of ways, which is why maybe that person, right, is not necessarily reinitiating again, right?
They never
Because
quit.
they never really quit. They stopped doing a behavior for a limited period of time, which reminds me of, like, some community reinforcement approach kind of language, which is oftentimes what I'll talk about with people who are maybe in, like, contemplation, is the idea, like, why don't we just try, like, a sample? Like, so, like, we'll just, change a behavior for a limited period of time that we agree that you make the decision for, and we're going to see what it looks like on the other side of that, whether or not those changes are associated with characteristics that you like that are new or different in your life, or maybe not so much. But it's been a long time since we've had this type of reduction or change happen with that behavior. Well, we don't even know what it would look like.
Or
And,
what you would look like.
Whether you like it or you don't like it or any of that kind of stuff. And I find that kind of language really helps a person be like, yeah, why don't I just try it on for a little while? I talk about, like, trying on clothes, right? Like, I'm gonna try it on and see how it fits. Maybe wear it out of the store. Maybe you can't put it back on the rack fast enough. But we're not just gonna do stuff because that's what we've always done. We're gonna now make decisions about what we want to do. And if returning to how things used to be is what you want to do, fantastic. But we're going to make that decision because a lot of times we arrive at the place that led us to, therapy because of a whole bunch of stuff we weren't really paying much attention to. It just kind of evolved slowly over time. And next thing I know, I'm smoking 3 packs a day, right? Or something like this. And it's just kind of evolved. And maybe, making a reduction down to 1 pack or making some key changes, like, I don't under these conditions or those types of things, and then create the infrastructure around it, I think is, a really helpful framework by which to think about. And I think people weren't really talking about that it things in this kind of way until, you and Jim and others have kind of put words to it, if that makes sense, or kind of divined it out of a lot of kind of things that were in the air in therapy.
No, I agree. And there have been lots of those different kinds of strategies to get people to think. I mean, motivational interviewing. That
Yeah,
was
the marriage
key.
between those two
And
things is just so amazing.
it works really well because there weren't very many treatments that focused on pre-action processes. And so motivational interviewing came in and kind of helped us with kind of focusing on that pre-action, those pre-action processes.
Yeah, that was one of the part in the motivational interviewing handbook. I remember when I was a wee graduate student that I read, and I was like, oh, like if they're already ready to change, like don't focus on this part. Like, but if they're not, and like to go into the rest of my therapeutic interactions from then on, just to be sort of thinking about this, like really checking out where an individual, my patient is, like in terms of stage to change, because it's a defense of their autonomy as well. And when you show someone that you respect their ability to sort of make their own decision about when they're ready to move forward, they're more likely to talk to you about it. Like that brings any contemplation that they might be hiding up there out into the open. And I agree. I think that is a it's just a wonderful marriage.
I mean, there's a lot of latent motivation, even in people who have decided not to. I mean, as we measured the stages, pre-contemplation in our algorithm measurements was, are you seriously thinking about quitting smoking in the next 6 months? Are you seriously thinking about doing this in the next 6 months? If you're not thinking about it in the next 6 months, it's way down the road. So that's why you're in pre-contemplation. Now, you may be in pre-contemplation for a lot of different reasons, and you may have be the strength of that pre-contemplation may be more or less. I mean, you could have somebody say, there's no way in hell that I'm going to ever do this. Okay, that's a harder pre-contemplation than people go, I think maybe in the next year or two I'll probably do this. But they're still in pre-contemplation from a process of change perspective. And all of us are in pre-contemplation for different kinds of behaviors. So when I do a talk out there, I say, I'm hoping that all of you are in pre-contemplation for using heroin. Okay. And if you're not, talk to me or something. But basically, I mean, we're in pre-contemplation for lots of things. Some of those you don't know, so it's really informational stuff. And this is where you'll see the processes alive if you watch television. Okay? Because all of the ads are geared to activating these processes of change. So they're trying to get you to do a self-reevaluation. They're trying to get you to do environmental reevaluation. That's why everybody's kind of happy and jumping in pools and doing stuff. You too can do this if it's there. So the processes aren't processes just in terms of our behavior change, in terms of they are in terms of behavior change, but they could be in terms of advertising.
Health behavior or not, right?
Right, unhealthy behaviors. So you can the process can work both ways, and it's really interesting. So that's in my book, Addiction and Change. The first part is how people become addicted, because actually, if we think about an addiction is really a well-maintained change. It's maintained by the physiology, it's maintained by the brain chemistry and the neurotransmitters, it's maintained by the habitual aspects of it. And it is a well-maintained change. And that's why now that if you're in maintenance for this well-maintained change, you're in pre-contemplation for getting out of it. And so the second part of the book is really about the recovery process. And that's another thing I think that is really interesting, that SAMHSA now calls recovery a process of change, whereby people become more live more self-directed lives. And I think that's a nice way to kind of frame what maintenance would be like, in terms of kind of moving through this process and maintaining it, but maintaining it by kind of building healthy, quality of life kinds of things. It's not just leaving something, but it's really going towards something.
Well, and I feel like maintenance sort of requires you to go to like identify something, a behavior that might help you maintain the change, right? And so that's going into contemplation and then prepping, like, oh, do I need to like organize? Do I need to have regular meetings with someone, right? So it's sort of maintenance in a way is sort of this constant miniature model of change.
And
I
when
think
you
that's really
change
interesting.
one thing, there's another, you find that there are other things that you need to change.
Yeah, we live
It's
very
never ending, right?
it
Yeah,
lives. Yes, right. There's
is
all these kind it?
of environmental constraints and things like that that need to be changed on their own to help create the support, right? Like as you mentioned, if a addiction is characterized by a very well maintained change, right? And then we self-select into environments that help support those things, whether those are people, places, and
You
things, right?
build
Which are,
around it.
you build a life around it. If it's, if it's kind of something that shows up, especially when you're talking about like substance use, for instance, that, has multiple events across a day, each day, it's, you construct a life around it, right? And so then to change that requires to change, for some, these environmental constraints or the environmental constraints interfere with the process of change that require their own changes. Like maybe I shouldn't hang out with these folks anymore, and then that I have to have go through a whole process with that. And it's all these little mini loops within it, which is one of the, I think, the things that just really adds, depth to the model, and that these show up in these, kind of microscopic ways and these kind of macro ways, as we think about change, and that allows us to characterize a process or all the kind of secondary components to it as well. And I do think that, just as a therapist, really kind of making sure I understand where a person sits in those things, or maybe where they are today, right? Or at this hour, where they are on these various processes, just helps us to support them in the ways that they need to be supported, which is kind of, similar to motivational interviewing, kind of really antithetical to the ways that things we're thinking about maybe pre this model in the 60s and 70s, where things were a lot more confrontational or maybe even more shame-based, like get it together, which doesn't really respect the autonomy, as Sam mentioned, but really just the where they are in the process of change, or the change takes time, and the more well-maintained the behavior is that I'm trying to change, the harder it's going to be, and the more individual pieces are I'm going to need to move around on the chessboard to unlock where I want to go, just require some time and some love from the folks around them.
Yeah, no, the other thing, the key thing I think that really kind of changed perspective was that this is also a cycle that people, we thought of relapse originally, we thought of relapse as a stage of change. But it wasn't. When we really looked at relapsers, they were all over the place in terms of our measures and stuff. And so we realized that relapse is much more of an event, and that triggers a recycling. And so it's the recycling that I think is really critical to understand, because many people don't make a change the first time they try. I was saying nobody does, but then there was always somebody in the room who would go, I am in it the first time. So
good
I
for you.
So it's possible to do it the first time you try, but many people have to try multiple times. And so that's the other piece of the process, is why do you have to try so many times? What's the function of this relapse process or this reoccurrence process? Well, the function is you have to learn how to do the tasks of the stages well enough to become successful. Because a lot of people talk about relapse as kind of, oh, it happened in the action stage, and so that's really where you have to kind of focus. No, the decision could have been not strong enough to support the pain of initiating action. The concerns or interests might have been because I wanted to save my marriage, not because of I wanted to do it myself.
Yeah.
So you have to get it. Even if you talk to self-changers, they'll say, well, this time I got it right. I did the right thing. My plan was better. My commitment was higher. So the function of this recycling is really to get the process right. And I think we stigmatize relapse unfairly, because relapse or reoccurrence or failure happens a lot in almost all domains
in life.
And the point is, how do I learn from this rather than how do I marginalize the people who are relapsers? We've done that a lot.
I always use with patients the metaphor of riding a bike, and it's like, well, when you first started to learn how to ride a bike, you didn't know how to do it, and you probably fell, you probably scraped your knee, you were probably using training wheels, and over time you sort of took some of those constraints off, you got a little better, but then you entered a new situation, you went down a hill for the first time, maybe you fell again,
right,
and then you learned how to go down a hill, right? So it's a normal process of learning how to exist without something you had before. I love to sort of throw in, or I love that you've thrown in, like, this stages of change to that sort of in my mind now, to that metaphor, which is just like, okay, what do we need to do to sort of like address anything along the way that's going to maybe be a barrier?
Could help. Yeah. I think that's really the issue, is really that, that change does take time, and it is a learning. It's a successive approximation learning, as opposed to one trial learning. But most of us have in our head that we should be able to change in one trial. But that's not really how it happens. So it's interesting. I'm actually working now on a book on relapse and recycling to try and kind of help us understand this whole, the function of failure.
I look forward to reading that. I think that's also part of maybe some of the radical paradigm shifts that kind of there's a couple of people that are happening that are working in this space at the same time. It sounds like, Alan Marlatt, for instance, with, abstinence violation effect, and like those types of, relapse prevention oriented language to understand it. You and Jim Prochaska talking about, Stages of Change, right? And then you got Bill Miller, talking about these types of things. And I think, when the powers combined at that and during that era really pushed our understanding forward. And it's still, I think, a lot of vestigial kind of cultural frameworks to think about substance use and addiction and recurrence and return to use and terms like relapse and all that stuff kind of hang out from us from before
From
these
before.
things. And I think we really need to spend some time. We were talking to Katie Wickwitz not that long ago about trying to re-understand some of these types of things. And I think our field is really at a space where that is well timed. And I think your book would probably be a great service to the field on top of many things that you've already done.
Hopefully.
It's been absolute delight talking to you. One thing that we always like to ask people here at the end is like, what do you think still needs to be done in this space? Like, what do you think the horizons are for us? It sounds like, talking about recurrence and things like this is definitely necessary, but what do you think still needs to be done?
So I think a lot needs to be done in terms of how we conceptualize the process. I mean, what I learned in some ways from several people that I interviewed was that, when you're especially with our in our substance use problems, it takes a while for the brain to readjust. And I'm not sure that we've given, the 28 days when in the early days, and now it's 2 weeks, and then into this, or maybe now there are 9 month programs, but nobody will pay for them. So basically, they're all cutting back to less time, even in the other field. So I do think we need to understand a little bit more about how much time it takes for someone's brain and body to readjust. And the other piece that I think is really important is that we need to understand that it doesn't it, you can teach some things, but we don't have a pre-therapy kind of place where people can go and get themselves kind of or reoriented. Because that's what one guy told me. He said the first 2 months I was in this 9 month treatment program is I took walks in the woods. Just to get back in touch with who I am so that I could make the change. So again, a lot of people have lost a lot in the addictions, and I think we need to kind of think about that more holistically, in terms of that.
That's a really great point. And unfortunately, American hustle culture and capitalism and things like that interfere with these. Everything needs to be optimized and fast and
No
efficient.
time to connect with ourselves.
I was just reading, somebody was talking about this about like in science, just like slow down and think deeply about stuff. And like, a lot of the metrics for science alone don't even permit that. And, we're talking about making, big time changes to a person's life and they need some time to sit with it. To create systems that accommodate and facilitate that portion of it, I think are really important, and to understand the timeline of it.
It's why many of our articles don't get written, because people are going from one grant to the next grant, and they never have time to
They
kind of
have
really kind of hum.
thousands
So,
of data points.
all these
That
data
does
points,
not
but
characterize
I
my life at
sorry,
all.
I got to move on.
That's the battle of every day, it seems like around here.
We need a f systems level a trans-theoretical
Shift.
model of change.
We need to think about it from the systems levels for sure.
It is interesting. It actually has been applied to preparedness, emergency preparedness, trying to get communities to kind of be prepared to kind of deal with disasters.
Oh yeah,
And
that
some
makes
of that
sense.
kind of stuff, and so it's interesting. It has people have tried to move to the more system or organizational level and think about organizational change from that perspective as well. So,
Yeah, it makes total sense. Makes total sense. Well, Carlo, it's been an absolute delight chatting with you. If it's all right, maybe we could pivot to our take-home messages.
Sure.
And so, these are just kind of designed to be kind of bite-sized chunks for different kinds of audience members. And so I was wondering if you could tell us maybe what you think the take-home message is for individuals who are interested in making a change.
So I think that the message of the model is hope, that basically you just got to keep trying. And that's really the process. Never give up. Keep trying. You get it right. I mean, get the support systems you need, but if you keep trying, you can be successful.
What would the take homes be for practitioners?
So I think practitioners have got to, I think maybe we talk about cultural humility, but maybe change humility. We need to kind of have that same perspective of kind of we're here to facilitate your work, the
Yes.
work of the client, the work that is really change, and to try and help understand that dilemmas that the folks are in terms of making these changes. The other thing I think practitioners need to do is to figure out how to make our treatments, I talked about more intensive at the beginning, but more extensive, because we need to be there. We need to have people coming back to us. You know, if you go to your dentist and you have a, if you have tooth is start still aching, you go back to your dentist. But if you're having problems out in the field in terms of making these changes, people don't tend to go back because the program is over. And so we just need a way to kind of think about broadening the scope of our work and allowing our people to kind of come back to us and talk about their failures as well as their successes.
Yeah.
What do you think the take-home message is for policymakers?
Well, that we just talked about some of it. I think some policymakers need to understand that this isn't something that's a fast you can quickly kind of get rid of. And so we need supports in place for longer periods of time. It doesn't have to be intensive. It doesn't have to be a hospital, but we do need supports, housing support, other kinds of support for folks that really need the kind of space to be able to kind of turn their lives around. So I think that's it. I call it in some of my talks scaffolding. That we need to provide good scaffolding for people because essentially, if you're thinking especially about addictions are a problem of self-regulation. And the folks who become get into these problems are often people who don't have good self-regulations to start, who have may have some impaired executive cognitive functioning and emotional regulation. And so you need to kind of provide some support and scaffolding of that self-regulation in order for that to for them to really have the space. And so I think that's what our folks need to know in terms of policymakers.
Yeah. What about underserved populations?
Well, in the underserved populations, again, it's part of this is actually the scaffolding, because again, we don't bring enough resources to them to be able to kind of help them. They're already feeling hopeless. They're already living in context. This is also where the context of change is kind of critical, because we have people living in these situations. And it was interesting, Mary Velasquez did a research project once where, she was studying women, trying to kind of get women to use birth control and not to become pregnant after they had come out of jails. But in Harris County at that time, they would let the women out of jail at midnight so that they wouldn't have to pay another day of support for them. So who's out at midnight waiting for them? Are all the people that they had done worked with before and got them into trouble in the first place. So basically, if we don't really kind of look at systemically, I think we have to look at that whole the underserved population in a more systemic way, even than if somebody has resources, they don't need a whole bunch of services sometimes. They can kind of get themselves together and go, and because they have the resources to look for alternatives. When you look in the underserved population, you don't have the you don't have the incentives, you don't have the decisional the cost benefits analysis doesn't really compute for them. And so we really need to kind of get in and where they are and provide some underpinning for the process of change.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. The last question that we ask our guests is that you've trained a lot of amazing psychologists over time, and you've had such a just an interesting journey. And we're wondering if you have any, career advice out there for trainees who might be listening.
Okay. Yeah, I thought about that when you asked me to do this, and that this was something part of it. So I would say to be open to opportunity and serendipity. That as I said from the beginning of my career, I didn't realize where from when I started where I would end up. I mean, I was becoming a therapist. That's what I wanted to do, not a researcher or not a developer of models or any of that kind of stuff. But opportunity is there, and serendipity happens. And so take advantage of that. I think it's important to have big ideas. And the challenge is, how do you take a big idea and make a manageable project out of it? And that's, you need to kind of scale down and kind of get that, and then that helps move the big idea. Use qualitative information as well as quantitative. Talk to people. I think that's really something that we've done in most of our research, and it really is valuable to kind of find out the experience of people in terms of what they're going through. Find good and great collaborators. A science is not a, is not a single person thing that it used to be. Used to be, you'd have your lab, you do what you want to do, you just publish your work, you kind of do that. These days, we're looking at system science, we're looking at implementation science, we're looking at a lot of different kinds of sciences, and it's much larger. And so you need good collaborators to work with to create projects that are fundable, as well as ones that really kind of produce good science. And finally, we're not in competition with one another. We're in competition with finding the truth, or finding the reality, or finding the scientific explanation for this particular thing. And so I do think that sometimes we get into kind of too much competition and not enough collaboration. So I think that's another suggested piece. So those are some ideas that I have from my career and my experiences that hopefully will help some of the younger folks coming up.
Well,
Thank
those
you
are
so
some
much.
fine points, I think,
Great
here.
points,
And
yeah.
yeah, great points. And I think they'll do a great service as much as any of the other work that you've done here has just been a great service to the field. And it takes a long time to figure out how to do this, right? Becoming a professional psychologist is a change process in its own, right? And it requires
Exactly.
learning these individual processes here about how to collaborate, how to lean into serendipity or chance, which really is now after this is a lot. We've done a few episodes now, and that shows up almost every episode. Just the total chance nature of, like, oh, I just ended up like switching advisors, and then poof, trans theoretical model change, like.
Exactly.
I talked to just a person who enrolled in a thing, qualitative interview, and then next thing you know, we're like, wow, what a very interesting idea. And then bang, here we go. And so I think your points are really well taken, and it's just been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. And thank you for your time.
Thank you both for your work, and hopefully it really helps the field move forward.
Thank you.